You're listening to Upside Down Podcast. This is Lindsay Wallace.
And I'm Kayla Craig.
I'm Patricia Taylor.
And I'm Alisa Molina. Upside Down Podcast is an ecumenical conversation at the intersection of justice, spirituality, and culture.
And we've created this space with you in mind.
So join us for unscripted conversations on God's Upside Down Kingdom.
Welcome to Upside Down Podcast. I am Kayla Craig, and I'm so excited to have this conversation with you today. Joining me is co-host Patricia Taylor. Patty, say hello.
Hey, everyone.
And we have a fun guest with us today. Now, the person that's joining us is a second timer on Upside Down Podcast, which doesn't happen very often. So I think that speaks to kind of the quality of the person that Justin is. So Justin McRoberts, welcome back.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yay.
We are really looking forward to talking. We have a lot of questions we want to ask you. So good. We'll see how many we even get to.
That's great. But
we have a long list.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good.
So our listeners might remember you from episode 52, Living on a Prayer, when Justin and Scott Erickson, who has been a co-creator with Justin on some books and projects, hopped on a call with us to talk about prayer. Mm-hmm. And I think we went down like 50,000 rabbit holes, give or take. Yes. And it was wonderful. So we're really excited to have you back on. Justin has written books, recorded albums, and he also hosts the At Sea podcast.
Yes.
And I know from experience that he asks very thoughtful, thought-provoking questions there.
Thank you.
And what is really exciting is he has a new book. And Justin, just right off the bat, why don't you tell us a little bit about it, and then we will just throw lots of questions your way.
The next book is called It Is What You Make of It. I almost got my title wrong. It Is What You Make of It. And it is a, and it is an active and playful and very intentional and hopefully thoughtful pushback against the idea that it is what it is, that really anything is what it is, that almost everything with, I think there are certainly some exceptions, but pretty much everything is a matter of will and circumstance, that even things like monolithic, seemingly immovable things like economics or systemic racism, those things aren't simply what they are. They are that way because people have, over the course of time, through multiple choices and the patterns of choices, established things to be that way. So nothing is what it is, which is to say even my own personal circumstances aren't simply what they are. In some great effect, they are as I've deemed them to be or willed them to be. And in the future, I get to make decisions about the pieces and the circumstances and the steps I take.
I like that. Oh. So we were talking, and Alisa, who's not on this call, she was on our other episode, but she had a question, and I want to make sure I get to it right away as we're starting, because I'm sure I'll, you know, go off on another 50,000 rabbit trails. But she wanted to know where discernment comes in when you're at a moment in your life when you're making a decision, when you're pivoting. How do you kind of put that mindset into your discernment process?
There are several answers to this. This is what I find is a lot of discernment ends up being reverse engineering anyways. In other words, for me, my discernment process rarely happens in the moment. What I recognize is that from where I'm standing, I almost never have enough altitude over the particular circumstance I'm in to look at it and feel like, oh, I know exactly what's going on here and I know exactly what's right. I'm almost never there. I'm almost always lost. I think this is, I know this is true of me. God, I hope it's true of other people. I'm almost always lost in my own moment. And so what I can do in the discernment mostly looks like either one, referencing things outside of myself, whether it has to do with like conversations with folks who are not me, but care about me, and looking back over the course of my history at similar things, which is where things like journaling, play a significant role. But like, I've been places like this before. What did that look like? So discernment, it doesn't take place in the moment. So it doesn't really have a role in the moment. It's almost always retroactive or communal in the given space. Mm-hmm. Like what are the voices that are not me saying to me, if they're voices that care about me? And what has this felt like and looked like before? That's usually the way discernment plays out in like that particular moment. And at that point, given that information, next steps are almost always like an act of sheer will, because there's just no certainty. I think part of, and maybe this is the longer answer to that question, and you can edit this down if you want to. I think, and I don't think this is what she meant necessarily by the question, I think the mistake I've made in the past is that through the process of discernment, I never come to certainty. What I come to is a sense of movement, a sense of I can and possibility. Hmm. So where discernment has been mistrained in me is like there's some sort of spiritual discernment by which I would understand, like, here's the will of the Lord.
The heavens open up and it's like, oh.
I never, ever, ever feel that way. I'm never like, no, it's like, I think, I bet, I hope, given all this information, I think, I bet, I hope. And then it's really just the will to act.
Patty, you are a journaler, right?
Yes.
How does this resonate in you? Because you've been making a lot of kind of big changes and pivot points in your own life.
Right. Well, I had so many thoughts just now. Because the thing is, I mean, for me, I, in an ideal situation, I'm a planner. And so the idea of taking things one day at a time, which is squarely where I am in my current circumstance, is so incredibly uncomfortable. And I have to work really hard to stay present where I am today and really trust that, you know, tomorrow will be what it's going to be and to see what happens along the way. There have been times I can say where I have had those like clear, like angel singing, burning bush, moments, but mostly no, that's not the case. And mm-hmm. So I'm just thinking about like where I am now and how this is so applicable because I think about this idea of a fear attached to that, right? Like what if I missed it?
Yep.
Like I want to be slow in making that next move. I want to be slow in going in that direction because what if I'm wrong? You know, what if it leads down some terrible path? What if I just missed it? Is it mm-hmm. going to be too late to course correct? Is it going to, you know, to be to my detriment? Will I hurt other people? And every situation isn't that dire, but I know that's a lot of what goes through my head and makes me slow to be able to jump both feet in.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And part of what I get to with this is like, at some point, I have to trust the fact that, so when you talk about like if I make a call, and there are two angles to this. If I'm standing in front of something, I need to make a decision. If I make a call and it's going to be, I'm afraid that I'll get it wrong. So two things happen in my head is one, if I'm not in a garbage place in my life right now, then I probably did a decent job of making decisions in the past. So I should probably trust myself up to a certain point. Like I haven't. And part of how I got here is I have made decisions that aren't great and I've been able to course correct. So what would make this different? So course correction, like it absolutely happened. So part of like, I don't know part, I don't know, but I do know that things have worked out and mostly because, this is a weird way to say it, I've made decent decisions. I haven't been highly irresponsible. In fact, if I'm asking questions about discernment, I'm probably someone who has some sense of responsibility to my life and my environment, which means mm-hmm. I can probably be trusted with the question and the decision in front of me. The other part of it, and I get to this with, I was just with a bunch of students, like 18, 19-year-old students in Pennsylvania in this gap year program called One Life. And the questions about what's next in life, it's why they're in the gap year program for the most part. It's like, I don't know what to do. And there's this legit fear that they're going to get it wrong. And some of it's like straight up theological that like God has a plan for me. What if I miss it? And right. I push back on that super hard. I'm like, what, which, and not everyone goes with this language and I don't entirely either, but I use it anyways, because other people do. What sounds like a good father to you? Does a good father say, okay, you've left your parents' house. There is a plan for you. I've hidden it. You can't see it very clearly, if at all. And I also haven't provided enough clues. But by faith, you might get it right, and I hope you do. Good luck out there. Or I've spent 18 years, 19 years, whether you knew it or not, shaping you and shaping your will. I've guided you by grace. I like who you are. I like the work I've done in you. Where do you want to go? What do you want to do right now? I'll go with you. Which one of those sounds like a good father? And for me, it's always the second one.
What's the response?
I watch kids light up because so few of us have had folks, like adults in our lives, say, what do you want to do?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thankful. Look, my mom's more that kind of person. My dad was not. My dad was scared to death that I was going to get things wrong. Literally. But to have adults say, what do you want to do? So even like just practicing that, I mean, your book on prayer, your prayer book, for parents. I mean, part of the deal is like I'm afraid I'm going to get things wrong, as a parent. And so I project that crap onto my kids.
Yeah.
Instead of saying like, I like you, I know you're 10. What do you want to do? How do you want to spend that money? Okay, cool. Let's go figure that out.
Usually Legos in my house.
Right. And that's awesome. Let's do that. Let's
play it out. LOL dolls, girl house.
So good.
Oh, I really appreciate that because I was thinking about what you said at the very beginning about discernment is often hindsight. And so I was trying to reconcile that thought with the idea of, what if you're younger and you don't have experience to have that hindsight? So what's that starting point? So I think you just answered that. Is there more you would add to that? If you're talking about 10, 15, 20 years younger version of yourself, trying to discern what's next and make these changes?
Kind of, no. I mean, and this is why actually I'll point at the book here for a second, is this is where the gift, like this is the tragic, this is the tragic, sad answer. This is where like dropping the ball on community and discipleship and mentorship is so freaking tragic. Because if you are 14, this is going to be mean. If you're a male, if you're a boy person, and you're anywhere between the ages of 13 and 26, you are probably stupid a little bit. And so with regards to like decision making, yeah, you're going to make a whole lot of messes relationally. And so how does that actually change? Theoretically, hopefully, like you have folks in your life who say, I'm with you, I've got you. So one of the cornerstone stories in the book is when I started playing music, Frank Tate, I actually mentioned that I asked this as a question when I had Kyla on the podcast. Frank Tate was a record label executive. I was living in his house and he was like, have you thought about playing music? And I said, no, but maybe I should. You think the songs are good? And he's like, no, I don't think your songs are good, but I like you. I was like, what? And then months later, I'm in Nashville, Tennessee at this showcase. And the showcase is label execs highlighting the artists that they're going to be focusing on during the year. And everyone gets up and they hand out a bunch of free stuff to the room. And then they talk about the artists behind them as like, you know, if all four Beatles were melted down and then forged into one person, this is who this next artist is. Like everyone's getting intros like that. And Frank gets in, I'm like fourth or fifth or sixth, or I don't know. I'm deep in the morning. Frank gets up in front of everybody and says, I'm Frank Tate. I'm with 5 Minute Walk. And behind me is Justin McRoberts, who's the artist we'll be focusing on this year. And I'll be honest, he's not very good right now. Like to the whole room of people. And I'm standing behind him holding a guitar.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was legit, like confusing. And like there was an honest, like weird vibe in the room for a moment. And then he legitimately said, but here's what I'm saying. I'm guessing that most of the artists you see this morning probably won't be playing music 2 or 3 years from now because this is hard. I think Justin will be playing music 15 years from now, and I think it'll be way better, if not great. So I'm making a long-term investment. If you want to make it with me, great. And if you don't, I don't care. And then he walked off. And then I had to play a song that I knew sucked, which was the interesting part of the morning. But what he did for me as an adult was the thing that, God, I wish more adults would simply do. Is say, you're not where you're supposed to be right now, but I'm making a long-term investment in you. I'm going to find the thing that's interesting or you're interested in, and I'm going to help you do that and and like think of yourself in the long run, so that like I'm not scared anymore because I've actually got an adult in my life saying I'm with you for the long run. I'm with you for 15 years. I'm thinking about who you're going to become. Then my decisions aren't so like terrifying. They're just not. Like I could blow it, which I like the second record totally bombed. It was not a good record. We did not sell many. I still owe him money. But but I wasn't hung up on it. Like it didn't derail me because an adult had said, make decisions. I'll help you do that. Let's make work together. I'm with you for 15 years.
Mm-hmm. There's a part of your book and you say, I'm learning to intentionally look at what I've been given, including the more problematic parts of who I am. And instead of just saying, I'm just this way, or I am just the way I am, I'm asking myself, what can I make of this? Yeah. And I wonder how that connects to your spirituality, to your theology, to your view of God, kind of what we were talking about before a little with talking to these people in this gap year. How does this idea kind of shape what you believe about God and what you believe about yourself?
The specifically like the making of something with what I've got.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my journey process, this and there's a good and bad to this, has generally been relatively public. So when I started following Jesus, when I became a person of faith, a religious person, it was in the context of a pretty hyper evangelical culture. So I was a Young Life kid who came to faith through Young Life and then became a Young Life leader. So there's a way in which like I was kind of a Young Life leader before I was a Christian. It became about a matter. My faith was framed by passing it on. So there was always this outward, like, what can you say? What do you have to offer? Framework, which is good and bad. The good part of it was and is, I do feel a responsibility to pass myself on. As like that's part of what it means for me to be a person of faith. That if I'm in something. Or something's happening in my life, I do feel a responsibility, and I think it's a sacred one, to in some way, shape, or form make that process available to other people, to publicly process out loud. So part of what I get to make with whatever I've got on hand is I get to make relationship, I get to make community, I get to make other people who are lost feel lost, I get to make other people who are in similar circumstances feel less alone, I get to make questions, I get to make culture with my own personal journey. That's the one part of it. And the other part of it is the flip side of it. If I believe that about myself, that I make what I can with what I've been given, that's probably rooted in like my spiritual shape, which is probably then reflective of the heart of God, which is to say, I'm being made into. And so I don't have to be there yet. It's actually super fine. More than fine for me to be where I'm at because, and there are cheap ways to say this, because like where I am right now, God can do something with this. In fact, God is going to do something with this. So if I can believe that about myself and passing myself on, it's actually strangely easier for me to believe that about like my own formational process, that who I am right now can and will be, there's something to be made still of me.
I've seen you talk recently even, diving back into this idea of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith. And I feel like you have some unique insight and perspective. And I'm sure we could talk about this for a long time, but thinking about your beginnings, you know, in a very evangelical context, how have you made those changes and those faith explorations and growth while still maintaining kind of that anchor in Christ?
This is actually like a fuzzy answer. So you and I have talked about the way like practices, like for a while I hold my practices and then at some point if I'm faithful to my practices hold me, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's true of good religion in general. that if I'm constantly having to hold my crap together, I'm probably in or practicing some form of like lesser or maybe even just bad religion. So if I've got to hold my faith together, that might not be faith. Mm-hmm. So I don't this is why the fuzzy answer. There are things that I, there are things that I believe / know about the world and about God, about the way things are. I don't know that I can't really tell you why I still do. Mm-hmm. I just know that I do.
I think that's a very relatable feeling.
Yeah. And they're not, they're not like cultural things. They're like just these rooted, like this is what I mean. It's like a really fuzzy answer. I'm going to paint an image. One of my clients says this all the time, was like, she'll speak really, really, really clearly in like image and color. She's like, this is sort of an orange. I'm like, I totally freaking get that. It is orange. there is this anchor, like this honest to goodness, like tether from like the middle of my soul somewhere that really does have me, like, I feel held and I feel and experience solidity. I don't feel like that. I'm not afraid of letting go of stuff. I'm not afraid of not even doubting stuff. I'm not afraid of not believing things. There's something in me that's like, I've got you. We're good. Mm. And I can't articulate it outside of saying like, there's like this light yellow glowing like anchor thing in me that has me like tethered to the ground beneath my feet, regardless of where I'm standing. It's just an experience. It's like, it's a thing I can bear witness to, but I can't really explain. And it's never really gone away. I've had it. And it's not an assurance. It's not like, well, I can't say, look, it's these things and here's the creed that comes along with it. I'm like, I can't write a creed around it. I just know that it's there and it makes me feel way the hell safer than the creeds do.
Mm. Gosh, Patty, I feel like you gotta have something to say about
this. I do. Well, I'm back at you saying I feel held.
Yeah.
And the power in that is so profound because there's a sense of safety in knowing that you're held that gives you the freedom to explore, even if you don't know where it's going to take you. Mm. And I just think about the risk or what's at risk if we're not willing to change.
Yes.
Or if we're not willing to evolve. And I think a lot of the unwillingness comes from that lack of security, that lack of safety when we don't feel held.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm just thinking of the person who's listening who's saying, that's great, but I don't feel that way right now.
Yeah.
Like I feel lost and I want to make a change, but it feels too risky. Like I'm unstable. I'm risky where I am. I'm going to be risky wherever I'm going. Like it's going to be a risk and it just feels like too much. So how do we get to this place of this image that I really have so vivid in my mind of being held and being secure enough and being rooted and grounded enough to say the risk is worth it?
Yeah. This is where, like, again, like mentorship, coaching, discipleship, community all really come in because that risk is super, super, super hard to make, but it's actually the only thing. Like there really is that really is actually the only thing. There isn't a way to secure myself in taking the risk so that I can get to a place of recognizing my own anchoring. Like I think I want to say this out loud. There's this weird, like, cultural and internal spiritual abuse that we basically describe by saying, like, I'm not happy where I am, but I'm scared to leave because I don't know what's outside of it, and I'm more afraid of what's outside of this. I'm more afraid of what life looks like outside of feeling detached and depending on who you are, used in this religious context. I'm more afraid of what it would feel like. I know this pain and I know this disillusionment well enough to feel comfortable in it. That's to some degree what we end up saying. And I'm like, oh my God, leave. Because it can't be worse. Like the worst case scenario is I leave the safe environment in which I feel used and detached or disillusioned or disconnected or misshapen, and end up in another place in which I feel the same things. That's the worst case scenario. If I don't feel attached where I am, if I don't feel beloved, let's just say it like that, if I don't feel beloved where I am, my worst case scenario is I leave here and I'm still no longer beloved. I'm still not beloved somewhere else. That's it. And so all there is to get to that place of, to discover if there's a way or a place or a pattern or a culture in which I can feel beloved, can feel attached, can feel that spiritual anchoring. All there is actually taking the risk. That's it. It's sort of like people who strike out in entrepreneurship. Like, is it going to work? We could do all the math if you want to, but you have no real idea until you give it a shot. Tell me 3 years from now if it worked. But you have to go do it. I know it's a trash answer, but that's what I got.
No, it's not.
No, that wasn't trash at all.
This was like, why he preached it to me right now? Okay, I hear you.
I was thinking the same thing about you.
I was just like, okay, I hear you.
Justin's been creeping on our Voxer messages.
Right, for real. That discernment.
It's not creeping. There's an app you can use to listen to it publicly.
Oh my goodness. So how, okay. So I have another question. I told you we came ready. So then you just said so much. I don't even know where to go next. Okay. Another factor that is so embedded in our culture, which also I definitely believe stunts our risk taking, is this idea of success. So what if I'm not successful in this thing? And you just mentioned it with, you know, businesses, and you strike out and you fail. But how do you Justin, measure success? And how do you, what parameters, if there are any, do you think we should use to measure our success?
I measure success by relationship, period. That's it. So I've gone through this in a bunch of different ways. And I used to say, which isn't untrue, but like success is a moving target. I get to decide what success means. Which is to some degree true. So at some point, again, if I'm an adult making my own decisions and I've been raised decently well and trained decently well, then success really is, it's what it's like. I get to decide what target I want to hit. So there's this great story. Dan Hasseltine from Jars of Clay tells it, like their first record, which is their debut record, was this enormous out of the freaking blue hit. Like they didn't spend a ton of money on the record, and then they sold like something like 2 million records or something. It was like it was millions of records. Maybe it was more than two. It was a bunch of millions. It was several million records, a couple million. I don't know. It was a lot. So, which like for me, like I couldn't give away a million records. So I'm like, it's bananas. And this is just four dudes who never made a record before. They just got out of college. They're from South Carolina. Nothing from South Carolina sells that well. So they sold like, however many millions of records. And then their second record sold like half that. So it was like 1.5. I think it was like 3 million records the first one, and the second record sold $1.5 million. And I'm like, 1.5 million copies. And I'm like, 1.5 million records is bananas. The label saw that record as a failure, which is absolutely insane. They literally called in a meeting. They said that they considered the record a failure because it sold half as many as the first record. My deal is like, see, that's where the moving target is. So if I feel like I'm a failure in my own stuff, most likely it's because I'm using someone else's metric to measure my own efforts. So I would feel very happy with 1,500. That'd be great. But it's like, if I'm unhappy or I feel unsuccessful, I'm measuring that by someone else's metrics. That was the first phase of things for me in terms of success. Cause I don't sell that many of anything. Like my podcast downloads are not insane. I don't sell truckloads of books. I never sold out that much music. What I do know is exactly what Frank Tate said, is like, I've been doing this. I'm 47 years old. I've been doing this since I was 23. I'm freaking still here, which means there are people in the world who still want the things I bring to the table. to hell with everything else. I'm still here, people. That's the thing. And I'm here because people want me to be here. So success doesn't have to do with the numbers as numbers. They have to do with the numbers as representations of relationship. Are there people in the world who care about what I do? Are there people in the world who care about me? And if that's the case, then I get to still be here. So me still being here is success. That's the way I think of it now. It's just relationship. And if there are numbers, they're only representative of relationship, because it's a relationship that keeps you going.
So what would you say to somebody, you know, this year has been such a tough and kind of lonely, isolating year. What would you say to somebody who is like, what does that leave me? I don't have a lot of relationships in my life. Yeah. Like, I guess almost like an encouragement not to give up, because, you know, if that's how, you know, you measure success.
Boy, that's good. I don't know. I mean, I there's probably something there about why you don't have people around you and the place you're in, the, you know, their avenues available kind of thing. I don't really know. There's probably a little bit of we'll go back to the beginning, a discernment process. How did I get here?
Yeah.
It's rarely, I'm going to say something hard, actually. It's rarely the case. It sometimes is. It's not never the case, but it really is rarely the case that we end up alone because everyone else sucks. Sometimes that's true. If you're a queer kid in an evangelical culture, I get that. You probably ended up alone. Right. Now, that probably wasn't you. But like those are very sad and far and really tragic and needs to change. But most of the time when we mean that, there's a little bit of self-work to be done there. So I have to figure out why do I feel that? What do I really want out of a relationship? So part of that ends up being has been for me, when I've looked around and thought and felt, I felt that I was and felt that I was alone. I'll just tell a story. So this is 7 or 8 years ago. And kind of was part of the story. Like, you know, I was in the throes of like losing a church culture, what was a pastor, and church stuff falling apart. And I looked around, I felt very, very, very alone in my life in general. And it took my wife saying there are people you don't call anymore because you don't think about them, or they're not the kinds of friends you think you want. And I recognize that the metrics by which I was measuring, like, am I connected or not? I was looking for really specific things in friendship. Like, I wanted people who were a lot like me, who knew my circumstances, who I didn't have to explain myself to, like all the things we say, right? And I didn't want to do some of the work it was going to have to take to be like actually attached to some of the folks who were actually asking for my time, who just like didn't care that I was a pastor, didn't know my church history, like had never read any of the books, never listened to the music. They're like, I don't know, you're just my neighbor. You live 2 doors down. You want to hang out? And I was like, no. I was ignoring things because I had a really narrow metric for like who I wanted to be attached to. And so I ended up feeling very isolated and alone. The pandemic thing has changed that to some degree for folks because of some of the doors of it that have been closed in our face with relationship. But we rarely end up alone just because everyone else sucks. It's usually like I need to figure some stuff out for me, and I have to figure out what it is that I want in a relationship so that I can maybe make some steps forward. That's my best shot at an answer.
Yeah. Patty, you have anything to add?
I'm like, well, no, I was just thinking about, because we mentioned the pandemic and so many just shifts, whether it's a loss or shifts or changes in relationships and how we relate to each other and dynamics, so much of that is just out in front in a major way with social media. And I'm just curious to know what social media done for you, like how has it helped to rebuild where you are? How has it been detrimental? Has it changed, good or bad, because of the pandemic? Like how does social media play a role into this relational aspect that you mentioned?
I really like social media. I like the kind of connectedness I have. And it's I know that it's relatively limited. So when I talk about by what metrics or what do I really want? For the most part, I think I know what it is that I want. It's why I don't spend a lot of time on Twitter, because there's not a lot happening on Twitter that I want. I don't want that relationship. I don't want that formal relationship. I feel more connected insofar as I'm able to pay attention to people that I want to pay attention to. I can keep up with folks. I mean, this is all the same stuff we normally say. You know what it is, honestly? I jumped on Twitter a year and a half after Twitter came on. I left for a little bit and came back. I've been at it for a long time. I think, Kyle and I, you and I talked about this on the podcast. Facebook is 16 or 17 years old. That's it. So the platform is new. The field is new. And I think we're generally, in general, trying to navigate how to do this well. So the curation process over the course of years, I just don't expect the same things I did when I started using Facebook. I know what I'm getting when I go there. And so I know what I'm there for. I know that I'm more of a broadcaster than I am a conversationalist on Instagram. And so because I know that, I show up, I do the thing, I'm getting the thing that I want, and then I'm done there. I just don't expect more than the thing is available. Yeah, I don't expect from the thing more than it is capable of giving me. And I've only known that by being there long enough and learning it in relationship to myself. So it's been good, but only insofar as I think I know what I'm going to get when I get there, and I'm not trying to get something else, if that makes some sense. I don't feel like I don't have better friends in the world per se. I do have more friends. I don't have better friends in the world, but I'm not looking, but Instagram and Facebook, definitely Twitter, they're not places, I don't think, for most of us to make better friends. They are places to make more friends, to hear more ideas. So if I'm showing up there for that, then I'll be happy. And if I'm showing up there because I really want to go deep with some people, that might not work out so well.
Yeah. I think of your book title. I mean, it's what you make it. part of that is the expectation, which I think is so key, and just being able to have a realistic expectation. Yes. Am I on here because I want this to replace something I'm missing? Am I on here because I'm looking for X, Y, and Z? And to be able to take it for what it is. And you're absolutely right. Even just amongst the different platforms, how does this function differently? And how is this serving me? How am I looking for it to serve me?
Yes.
And I think that just being able to have that awareness sounds like for you, it's come with time, And so I just think of the importance of growth and measuring growth, which I think that our conversation as a whole is not there's not a black and white, definitive anything of what we've talked about. Mm-hmm. But is there a way that you can say that when you've grown and certain cues, certain things that you can look for that you can say, okay, hey, I have actually grown from this place where I was 5 years ago or 1 year ago or 1 month ago? How do you know that growth is happening?
Outside of other people, I have more peace. So if I'm growing, I'm more peaceful. I'm less anxious. I think that's mostly it. So other people making note of ways in which I've grown, I'll trust some people in my life to say you're better than you were, or I appreciate you more, other people's metric, other people saying things to me about other people that I love. The short list of people whose voices I fundamentally trust saying things to me about my growth. That's the primary metric. Outside of that, I have more peace. I have less anxiety. I'm not as nervous. It's not even a confidence, although that's maybe a way to put all those together in one word, peace and less anxiety. But it's not big chested, yeah, I'm great. But there definitely is more of a sense of being happier with who I am. I think my soul knows. I think the soul does know. I think the body knows too. I think the soul knows. Am I growing? I think the soul experiences peace when, if I can tell my soul to be still, then I've got a relationship with my soul. And I think there are times over the course of years that my soul actually says, hey, this is better than it was, don't you think? And I experience more peace and I'm happier with me.
I think something that you do really well and you've even done tonight in this conversation is share stories. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I connect with. And I feel like I'm kind of a storyteller. I'm always like, well, that reminds me of this story.
Yeah.
And you do that a lot in your book. You communicate a lot of different ideas with these stories from your life. And what I appreciated was that you aren't like the hero of the story a lot of the time, which I feel like I read a lot of books and we kind of tend to make ourselves the hero in things. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder what the power of telling stories, you know, and looking back and reflecting, even if we're just telling the stories to ourselves, because we're always telling ourselves stories, mm-hmm. but what's the power in actually being honest with the lens of which we're telling the story? That's not really a question, but just something I've been thinking about.
Yeah, I mean, you and I are similar so far. Like, I'll read books that I'll really want to read because, like, you know, I like the voice, I like the stories, and I constantly find myself like in the back seat of this car, being like, "You're driving too fast. Like, I cannot keep up with this." That would be awesome. I would love to live that way. I don't have that kind of money. So, or whatever, like, so I wanted to, which this has been a lot of my life. I'm trying to, it's been a lot of my life in Christ. I should say it like that. I am trying to tell my story in a way that invites other people in. And it's not like that, how should I say? It's not like frailty and failure, because they're not failure stories. They are stories about learning and process and growth and conflict. Everyone can recognize that. Very few of us recognize success as like an entry point into a relationship. Very few of us want to go through the doorway of failure into a relationship, but we can recognize struggle and we can recognize effort and we can recognize desire. And that's what I wanted to do with the book. These are stories like, here are things that I want to be true. There are places I'm wanting to grow, or, you know, growth curves. And I guess the power is like to become entry points for a relationship. Hopefully readers are like, oh yeah, like I would want that same thing. Funny that that's the way that happened for you. As opposed to like, I would like to be just like you. I don't want, and I don't think you come to the end of this book and you think like, oh gosh, I would like to be like Justin McRoberts. Like, no, you really don't. You don't want that. And I know you don't. And you know that you don't. But I do think you want to think that way in the course of your own life. I do think you want to take this tool and apply it to your own life because you recognize yourself in it. That's what I wanted to do. Similar with the prayer book, was like, I don't want to write a prayer book about like, here's how to pray. But I did want to write a prayer book that was like, what does it look like for you to pray in your own life? Like, is a book in which there's room for the reader was part of the intention, specifically with these stories.
And I feel like, so I read a lot of fiction. And I feel like stories have helped me get out of my own lens as, you know, a white woman who lives in the Midwest and, you know, is married to a man and has four kids. You know, like, that's my lens that I view the world from, a lot of different, you know, points. But there's a lot that I don't see. And so I feel like reading stories helps me grow in empathy and compassion and understanding, because I think we can read a lot of data points and we could read a lot of like how-to and instruction manuals. But until we see the humanity of another person, we're going to keep like missing each other, you know? And so I want to ask both of you, like, why are the stories we tell, you know, fictionalized or otherwise, but why are they important in, I don't know, like being human and seeing the belovedness of another?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, what you just said, Kayla, I think really is the is the answer, but how do you get there? You know, because the thing is, you still can choose what stories you want to listen to.
Right.
And I think we still have a tendency of choosing ones that are familiar and ones that reflect where we already are. And for myself, as a Black woman, I am very aware of how it takes so much intentionality to have people listen to my voice and hear my story. But then once that happens, then not always, but more often than not, there's a point of connection, or there is you're human. Yes, I sure am. I'm a real whole person. But I think that stories, they are a point of connection.
Yeah.
I think it's so easy for us to lack empathy and to be callous and to say, well, that's their problem over there. It's not my problem over here. Or even looking at a story that compels us, but still staying like far from it and not being willing to enter into that space.
Yeah.
And so if we stop telling stories, if we stop sharing stories, then we limit the opportunity for people to enter in and for people to really experience something that's different, something that can be transformative, something that can just be, maybe I just never thought of that. You know, it's not always with something, you know, some malicious intent. Sometimes I just don't know what I don't know.
Yes.
But if you listen to my story and if you are intentional about whose stories you're listening to, then I think it's a win for everyone.
That's good. Mm. I want to piggyback off the idea of entering in, because I think the thing when people talk about getting lost in a story, and like we appreciate that, like being lost in the story. There is a thing that happens. The difference between like data points and a story is with a story, I'm not in control. Like I'm along for the ride and I get to enter in. Whereas with data points, like the question is what, like, you know, I'm going to rip on my own book here. Like, well, you always got to do something with it. Like no, sometimes you don't. In relationship, like what if you just appreciated it? Like, you know, I get the question. I do a Q&A every Monday on Instagram which is great. Probably 5 out of the last 7 times I'll have folks ask me like, what have I read from Black authors that like helped me, you know, understanding or like, and I was like, oh, well, and I almost always reference Toni Morrison's Beloved, because it was the first time, first of all, it's just such a freaking amazing book because she's such an amazing author. So like I was captured by the story, for which I had so few actual like data points. Like I have no personal reference point for the most part for almost any of the like the pivot moments or the actual dramas. Like this whole conversation about, you know, why is our last name dead? And it was like that, like, well, your name is dead because when they asked your grandma, like, what's your last name? And she said, well, what's your husband's name? Is what she said. And she's like, what's your husband's name? She's like, my husband's dead. And so her last name is dead. I was like, and in my mind, I'm like, would you just correct that? Go back and correct that. But like, because I had no reference point for that kind of like powerless moment where like someone's just going to tell you who the hell you are. I had no idea. But I was along for the ride and I got to actually just appreciate it. And story does that. Story puts us in a position to not be in control so that I can actually be taken somewhere that I wouldn't go. Whoa, that's the Jesus moment, right? When Jesus says to Peter, he's like, you used to make all these decisions, son. Not anymore. Like, you want to be a leader, you're going to actually end up places you don't want to go. Peter got swept up into a story that was bigger than him. That's what story theoretically, hopefully, can do for us is, I want to get you somewhere. And not to be a punk, but like, I don't trust you to get there on your own if I just tell you how to go. So I'm going to tell you a story. And by the end of that story, I think you'll probably be somewhere better than you are now. But if I just give you the data points, you're going to make a freaking mess of this. And it's going to not look like it really should. Story takes us places. I think that's the big deal. I get to like, yeah, I get to actually enter in instead of feel like I'm supposed to do something with it.
Yes, all of that.
Yes.
both of you. I knew you were going to have great answers than you did. So
that was a setup.
Un- unfortunately, I'm like, oh, we've only been talking for like 20 minutes, right? And then I looked at him like, oh, nope.
We're deep already.
It's time.
Okay, so I want to ask one last question, yes, Justin. Please. You are a podcaster. Mm-hmm. What is your favorite question to ask others when they come on your podcast?
I like asking the 15 years question. Who do you see yourself being in 15 years? Where do you want to be? What's the world around you? The question I ask is like, if everything you're planning, thinking, strategizing, hoping for, if everything plays out the way you want it to, your best case scenario, what do you look like? What's your world look like? What's the world around you look like in light of your work 15 years from now? That's my favorite question.
And what is your answer?
15 years from now, I hope that, really specifically, this is such a weird thing to keep saying. I really hope that religious culture is smaller. That we talk more about religious cultures. That there's more of an actual conversation about smaller pockets of things. That we feel more responsibility for smaller things. Right now, we just feel so. There's just so much responsibility for things that are just so big. And I hope that we feel much smaller, much more responsibility for smaller circles of influence, and that there are just more circles of influence. That's the biggest thing I hope for. I want to.
That's really interesting.
And I would like to have a much smaller circle.
I'm not hearing other people saying that right now.
I would like to have a much smaller circle and feel really responsible for that. And then anything else besides that is freaking like icing. Maybe. I want to be happier with less, and not just stuff, cause I hate stuff, but I want to be happier with less influence. I want to be happier with less everything and just be really, really like burrowed down into a smaller space.
Very cool.
Wow.
Well, Justin, where can our listeners find you if they haven't connected with you on the internet yet?
I'm on the internet. I am on all the internet, so
even Twitter.
I'm on Twitter. It happens. I'll be there like once a day. Everything is just my name for the most part. Just search Justin McRoberts. Facebook, I think I'm Mick What's His Face on Facebook is the personal page. But if you search my name, Justin McRoberts, you go to the other page. So I'm just Justin McRoberts everywhere you go. And then the book is on Amazon.com. I prefer people to buy it from Byron Borger. At Hearts and Minds Books, but it's available for pre-order now. It comes out in June, but I'd love you to go grab it beforehand so that it shows up on your door when the egg cracks and all that.
Well, I've read it. I really liked it. I read it really quickly. I know it's going to be a good one to pass on.
Thank you.
Hope that our listeners check it out too. So we put our show notes just on Instagram because that's where we live. So all the things we've talked about today, you can find at Upside Down Podcast on Instagram. And we just want to shout out our growing Patreon community. Because of them, we keep this podcast free and free of ads. So thank you so much to every single person who gives. It matters so much to us. We've loved reading through Jamar Tisby's latest book, How to Fight Racism. Elisa has been leading that up. It's been just a gift. Patty, I know you were on the most recent call.
Yes.
You so give good. It 10 out of 10.
Absolutely. 11 out of 10.
11 out of 10. All right. Patty, where can listeners find us other places on the internet?
Well, yes, we do live on Instagram at Upside Down Podcast. You can also find out more at upsidedownpodcast.com, or you can always join the Upside Down Together listener group on Facebook, and that's a great place to process through episodes with the lens of God's Upside Down Kingdom. So we just, again, are so thankful for every single one of you. And we can't emphasize enough how much we appreciate seeing you share our podcast. It's a little podcast that could, and we keep going and going. So share with your friends, rate, review, and to all of our online communities, truly, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And Justin, thank you. I already can't wait to go back and listen to this episode when it comes out. So just thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us for this episode of the Upside Down Podcast. New episodes are released on the second and fourth Tuesday of each month. The Upside Down podcast is created by Lindsay Wallace, Kayla Craig, Elisa Molina, and Gina Siliberto. Our show notes are written by Lana Smith. Johnny Craig and Tess Malone edit the episodes, and our theme music is Dreamer's Act by DJ Sean P. And of course, our monthly patrons make everything possible. Thank you.